New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 8 of Zadig, or The Book of Fate by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig, or The Book of Fate. Chapter 8. The Thrashed Wife. Zadig steered his course by the stars that shone over his head. The constellation of Orion and the radiant Dog Star directed him towards the pole of Kenno. He reflected with admiration on those immense globes of light, which appeared to the naked eye no more than little twinkling lights, whereas the earth he was then traversing, which, in reality, is no more than an imperceptible point in nature, seemed, according to the selfish idea we generally entertain of it, something very immense and very magnificent. He then reflected on the whole race of mankind, and looked upon them as they are in fact a parcel of insects or reptiles devouring one another on a small atom of clay. This just idea of them greatly alleviated his misfortunes, recollecting the nothingness, if we may be allowed the expression, of his own being, and even of Babylon itself. His capacious soul now soared into infinity, and he contemplated with the same freedom as if she was disencumbered from her earthly partner, on the immutable order of the universe. But as soon as she cowered her wings and resumed her native seat, he began to consider that Astarte might possibly have lost her life for his sake, upon which his thoughts of the universe vanished all at once, and no other objects appeared before his distempered eyes but his Astarte giving up the ghost, and himself overwhelmed with a sea of troubles. As he gave himself up to this flux and reflux of sublime philosophy and anxiety of mind, he was insensibly arrived on the frontiers of Egypt, and his trusty attendant had, unknown to him, stepped into the first village and sought out for a proper apartment for his master and himself. Zadig, in the meantime, made the best of his way to the adjacent gardens, where he saw, not far distant from the highway, a young lady, all drowned in tears, calling upon heaven and earth for succor in her distress, and a man, fired with rage and resentment, in pursuit after her. He had now just overtaken her, and she fell prostrate at his feet, imploring his forgiveness. He loaded her with a thousand reproaches, nor did he spare to chastise her in the most outrageous manner. By the Egyptian's cruel deportment towards her, he concluded that the man was a jealous husband, and that the lady was an inconstant and had defiled his bed. But when he reflected that the woman was a perfect beauty, and to his thinking something like the unfortunate Astarte, he perceived his heart yearn with compassion towards the lady, and swell with indignation against her tyrant. "For heaven's sake, sir, assist me," said she to Zadig, sobbing as if her heart would break. "Oh, deliver me out of the hands of this barbarian! Save, sir, oh, save my life!" Upon these her shocking outcries, Zadig threw himself between the injured lady and the inexorable brute. And as he had some smattering of the Egyptian tongue, he expostulated with him in his own dialect and said, "Dear sir, if you are endowed with the least spark of humanity, let me conjure you to have some pity and remorse for so beautiful a creature. Have some regard, sir, to the weakness of her sex. How can you treat a lady who is one of nature's masterpieces in such a rude and outrageous manner, one who lies weeping at your feet for forgiveness, and one who has no other recourse than her tears for her defense?" "Oh, oh," said the jealous pated fellow in a fury to Zadig, "what, you are one of her gallants, I suppose? I'll be revenged of thee, thou villain, this moment." No sooner were the words out of his mouth, but he quits hold of the lady, in whose hair he had twisted his fingers before, takes up his lance in a fury, and endeavors to the utmost of his power to plunge it into the stranger's heart. Zadig, however, being cool, warded the intended blow with ease. He laid fast hold of his lance towards the point. One strove to recover it, and the other to snatch it away by force. They broke it between them. Whereupon the Egyptian drew his sword. Zadig drew his. They fought. The former made 100 rash passes, one after another, which the latter parried with the utmost dexterity. The lady sat herself upon a grass plat, adjusting her headdress and looking on the combatants. The Egyptian was too strong for Zadig, but Zadig was more nimble and active. The latter fought as a man whose hand was guided by his head, the former as a madman who dealt about his blows at random. Zadig took the advantage, made a plunge at him, and disarmed him. And forasmuch as he found that the Egyptian was hotter than ever, and endeavored all he could to throw him down by dint of strength, Zadig laid fast hold of him, flew upon him, and tripped up his heels. After that, holding the point of his sword to his breast, like a man of honor, gave him his life. The Egyptian, fired with rage, and having no command of his passion, drew his dagger, and wounded Zadig like a coward, whilst the victor generously forgave him. Upon that unexpected action, Zadig, being incensed to the last degree, plunged his sword deep into his bosom. The Egyptian fetched a hideous groan and died upon the spot. Zadig then approached the lady, and with a kind of concern, in the softest terms, told her that he was obliged to kill her insulter, though against his inclinations. "I have avenged your cause, and delivered you out of the merciless hands of the most outrageous man I ever saw. Now, madam, let me know your farther will and pleasure with me." "You shall die, you villain! You have murdered my love! Oh, I could tear your heart out!" "Indeed, madam," said Zadig, "you had one of the most hot-headed, oddest lovers I ever saw. He beat you unmercifully, and would have taken away my life because you called me into your assistance." "Would to God he was but alive to beat me again," said she, blubbering and roaring. "I deserve to be beat. I gave him too just occasion to be jealous of me. Would to God that he had beat me, and you had died in his stead." Zadig, more astonished and more exasperated than ever he was in all his life, said to her, "Really, madam, you put on such extravagant airs that you tempt me, pretty as you are, to thrash you most cordially in my turn, but I scorn to concern myself any more about you." Upon this, he remounted his dromedary, and made the best of his way towards the village. But before he had got near 100 yards, he returned upon an outcry that was made by 4 couriers from Babylon. They rode full speed. One of them, spying the young widow, cried out, "There she is! That's she! She answers in every respect to the description we had of her." They never took the least notice of her dead gallant, but secured her directly. "Oh, sir," cried she to Zadig again and again, "dear sir, most generous stranger, once more deliver me from a pack of villains. I most humbly beg your pardon for my late conduct and unjust complaint of you. Do but stand, my friend, at this critical conjuncture, and I'll be your most obedient vassal till death." Zadig had now no inclination to fight for one so undeserving any more. "Find some other to be your fool now, madam. You shan't impose upon me a second time. I'll assure you, madam, I know better things." Besides, he was wounded, and bled so fast that he wanted assistance himself, and 'tis very probable that the sight of the Babylonian couriers, who were dispatched from King Moabdar, might discompose him very much. He made all the haste he could towards the village, not being able to conceive what should be the real cause of the young ladies being secured by those Babylonish officers, and as much at a loss, at the same time, what to think of such a termagant and a coquette. End of chapter 8, The Thrashed Wife, recording by Jeffrey Allen Stumpf. Chapter 9 of Zadig, or The Book of Fate, by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig, or The Book of Fate. Chapter 9, The Captive. No sooner was Zadig arrived at the Egyptian village before mentioned, but he found himself surrounded by a crowd. The people, one and all, cried out, "See, see, there's the man that ran away with the beauteous Lady Missouf and murdered Cletophis." "Gentlemen," said he, "God forbid that I should ever entertain the thought of running away with the lady you speak of. She is too much of a coquette. And as to Cletophis, I did not murder him, but killed him in my own defense. He endeavored all he could to take my life away, because I entreated him to take some pity and compassion on the beauteous Missouf, whom he beat most unmercifully. I am a stranger who am fled hither for shelter, and 'tis highly improbable that upon my first entrance into a country where I came for safety and protection, I should be guilty of 2 such enormous crimes as that of running away with another man's partner and that of clandestinely murdering him on her account." The Egyptians at that time were just and humane. The populace, 'tis true, hurried Zadig to the town jail, but they took care in the first place to stop the bleeding of his wounds, and afterwards examined the supposed delinquents apart, in order to discover, if possible, the real truth. They acquitted Zadig of the charge of willful and premeditated murder, but as he had taken a subject's life away, though in his own defense, he was sentenced to be a slave, as the law directed. His two beasts were sold in open market for the service of the hamlet. What money he had was distributed amongst the inhabitants, and he and his attendant were exposed in the marketplace to public sale. An Arabian merchant, Setoc by name, purchased them both, but as the valet or attendant was a robust man and better cut out for hard labor than the master, he fetched the most money. There was no comparison to be made between them. Zadig, therefore, was a slave subordinate to his valet. They secured them both, however, by a chain upon their legs, and so linked they accompanied their master home. Zadig, as they were on the road, comforted his fellow slave, and exhorted him to bear his misfortunes with patience. But, according to custom, he made several reflections on the vicissitudes of human life. "I am now sensible," said he, "that my impropitious fortune has some malignant influence over thine. Every occurrence of my life hitherto has proved strangely odd and unaccountable. In the first place, I was sentenced to die at Babylon for writing a short panegyric on the king, my master. In the next, I narrowly escaped being strangled for the queen, his royal consort, speaking a little too much in my favor, and here I am a joint slave with thyself, because a turbulent fellow of a gallant would beat his lady. However, comrade, let us march on boldly. Let not our courage be cast down. All this may possibly have a happier issue than we expect. 'Tis absolutely necessary that these Arabian merchants should have slaves, and why should not you and I, as we are but men, be slaves, as thousands of others are? This master of ours may not prove inexorable. He must treat his slaves with some thought and consideration, if he expects them to do his work. This was his discourse to his comrade, but his mind was more attentive to the misfortunes of the Queen of Babylon. 2 days afterwards, Setoc set out with his two slaves and his camels for Arabia Deserta. His tribe lived near the desert of Horeb. The way was long and tedious. Setoc, during the journey, paid a much greater regard to Zadig's valet than to himself, because the former was the most able to load the camels, and therefore what little distinctions were made, they were in his favor. It so happened that one of the camels died upon the road. The load which the beast carried was immediately divided and thrown upon the shoulders of the two slaves. Zadig had his share. Setoc couldn't forbear laughing to see his two slaves crouching under their burthen. Zadig took the liberty to explain the reason thereof, and convinced him of the laws of the equilibrium. The merchant was a little startled at his philosophical discourse, and looked upon him with a more favorable eye than at first. Zadig, perceiving he had raised his curiosity, redoubled it, by instructing him in several material points which were in some measure advantageous to him in his way of business, such as the specific weight of metals and other commodities of various kinds of an equal bulk, the properties of several useful animals, and the best ways and means to make such as were wild tame by degrees and fit for service. In short, Zadig was looked upon by his master as a perfect oracle. Setoc now thought the master the much better man of the two. He used him courteously, and had no room to repent of his indulgence towards him. Being got to their journey's end, the first step that Setoc took was to claim a debt of 500 ounces of silver of a Jew, who had borrowed it in the presence of two witnesses, but both of them were dead, and as the Jew was conscious he couldn't be cast for want of evidence, appropriated the merchant's money to his own use, and thanked God that it lay in his power for once to bite an Arabian with impunity. Setoc discovered to Zadig the unhappy situation of his case, as he was now become his confidant. "Where was it, pray," said Zadig, "that you lent this large sum to that ungrateful infidel?" "Upon a large stone," said the merchant, "at the foot of Mount Horeb." "What sort of a man is your debtor?" said Zadig. "Oh, he is as arrant a rogue as ever breathed," replied Setoc. "That I take for granted." "But," says Zadig, "is he a lively, active man, or is he a dull, heavy-headed fellow?" "He is one of the worst paymasters in the world, but the merriest, most sprightly fellow I ever met with." "Very well," said Zadig, "let me be one of your counsel when your cause comes to be heard." In short, he summoned the Jew to attend the court, where, when the judge was sat, Zadig opened the cause. Thou impartial judge of this court of equity, I am come here, in behalf of my master, to demand of the defendant 500 ounces of silver, which he refuses to pay, and would fain traverse the debt. Have you, friend, your witnesses ready to prove the loan? Said the judge. No, they are dead, but there is a large stone still subsisting on which the money was deposited, and if your excellence will be pleased to order the stone to be brought in court, I don't doubt but the evidence it will give will be proof sufficient of the fact. I hope your excellence will order that the Jew and myself shall be obliged to attend the court till the stone comes, and I'll dispatch a special messenger to fetch it at my master's expense. Your request is very reasonable, said the judge. Do as you propose, and so called another cause. When the court was ready to break up, Well, said the judge to Zadig, is your stone come yet? The Jew, with a sneer, replied, Your excellence may wait here till this time tomorrow before the stone will appear in court, for 'tis above 6 miles off, and it will require 15 men to remove it from its place. 'Tis well, replied Zadig. I told your excellence that the stone would be a very material evidence. Since the defendant can point out the place where the stone lies, he tacitly confesses that it was upon that stone the money was deposited. The Jew, thus unexpectedly confuted, was soon obliged to acknowledge the debt. The judge ordered that the Jew should be tied fast to the stone, without victuals or drink, till he should advance the 500 ounces of silver, which were soon paid accordingly, and the Jew released. The slave Zadig and this remarkable stone witness were in great repute all over Arabia. End of chapter 9. The Captive. Recording by Jeffrey Allen Stumpf.
Chapter 10 of Zadig, or The Book of Fate, by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig, or The Book of Fate, Chapter 10. The Funeral Pile. Sitak, transported with his good success of a slave, made Zadig his favorite companion and confidant. He found him as necessary in the conduct of his affairs as the king of Babylon had before done in the administration of his government, and lucky it was for Zadig that Sitak had no wife. He discovered that his master was in his temper benevolent, strictly honest, and a man of good natural parts. Zadig was very much concerned that one of so much sense should pay divine adoration to a whole host of created, though celestial, beings, that is to say, the sun, moon, and stars, according to the ancient custom of the Arabians. He talked at first to his master with great precaution on so important a topic, but at last told him in direct terms that they were created bodies as others, though of less luster, and that there was no more adoration due to them than to a stock or a stone. But, said Sitak, they are eternal beings to whom we are indebted for all the blessings we enjoy. They animate nature, they regulate the seasons, they are, in a word, at such an infinite distance from us that it would be downright impious not to adore them. You are more indebted, said Zadig, to the waters of the Red Sea, which transport so many valuable commodities into the Indies. Why, pray, may not they be deemed as ancient as the stars? And if you are so fond of paying your adoration on account of their vast distance, why don't you adore the land of the Gangarides, which lies in the utmost extremities of the earth? No, said Sitak, there is something so surprisingly more brilliant in the stars than what you speak of, that a man must adore them whether he will or not. At the close of the evening, Zadig planted a long range of candles in the front of his tent, where Sitak and he were to sup that night, and as soon as he perceived his patron to be at the door, he fell prostrate on his knees before the wax lights. O ye everlasting, ever-shining luminaries, be always propitious to your votary, said Zadig. Having repeated these words so loud as Sitak might hear them, He sat down to table without taking the least notice of Satak. What, said Satak, somewhat startled at his conduct, art thou at thy prayers before supper? I act just as inconsistently, sir, as you do. I worship these candles without reflecting on their makers or yourself, who are my most beneficent patron. Satak took the hint and was conscious of the reproof that was concealed so genteelly under a veil. The superior wisdom of his slave enlightened his mind, and from that hour he was less lavish than ever he had been of his incense to those created beings, and for the future paid his adoration to the eternal God who made them. At that time there was a most hideous custom in high repute all over Arabia, which came originally from Scythia, but having met with the sanction of the begotted Brahmans, threatened to spread its infection all over the East. When a married man happened to die, if his dearly beloved widow ever expected to be esteemed a saint, she must throw herself headlong upon her husband's funeral pile. This was looked upon as a solemn festival, and was called the widow's sacrifice. That tribe which could boast of the greatest number of burnt widows was looked upon as the most meritorious. An Arabian who was of the tribe of Satak happened just at that juncture to be dead, and his widow, Almona, by name, who was a noted devotee, published the day, nay, the hour that she proposed to throw herself, according to custom, on her deceased husband's funeral pile, and be attended by a concert of drums and trumpets. Zadig remonstrated to Satak what a shocking custom this was, and how directly repugnant to human nature, by permitting young widows almost every day to become willful self-murderers, when they might be of service to their country, either by the addition of new subjects or by the education of such as demanded their maternal indulgence. And by arguing seriously with Satak for some time, he forced from him at last an ingenuous confession that the barbarous custom then subsisting ought, if possible, to be abolished. 'Tis now, replied Satak, above 1,000 years since the widows of Arabia have been indulged with this privilege of dying with their husbands, and how shall any one dare to abrogate a law that has been established time out of mind? Is there anything more inviolable than even an ancient error? But, replied Zadig, reason is of more ancient date than the custom you plead for. Do you communicate these sentiments to the sovereigns of your tribes, and in the meanwhile I'll go and sound the widow's inclinations. Accordingly, he paid her a visit, and having insinuated himself into her favor by a few compliments on her beauty, after urging what a pity it was that a young widow, mistress of so many charms, should make away with herself for no other reason but to mingle her ashes with the husband that was dead, he, notwithstanding, applauded her for her heroic constancy and courage. I perceive, madam, said he, you was excessively fond of your deceased spouse. Not I, truly, replied the young Arabian devotee. He was a brute, infected with a groundless jealousy of my virtue, and in short a perfect tyrant. But notwithstanding all this, I'm determined to comply with our custom. Surely then, madam, there's a sort of secret pleasure in being burnt alive. Alas, with a sigh, cried Almona, 'tis a shock indeed to nature, but must be complied with for all that. I am a professed devotee, and should I show the least reluctance, my reputation would be lost forever. All the world would laugh at me should I not burn myself on this occasion. Zadig, having forced her ingenuously to confess that she parted with her life more out of regard to what the world would say of her, and out of pride and ostentation, than any real love for the deceased, he talked to her for some considerable time so rationally, and used so many prevailing arguments with her to justify her due regard for the life which she was going to throw away, that she began to waive the thought and entertain a secret affection for her friendly monitor. Pray, madam, tell me, said Zadig, how would you dispose of yourself upon the supposition that you could shake off this vain and barbarous notion? Why, said Dame, with an amorous glance, I think verily I should accept of yourself for a second bedfellow. The memory of Ashtart had made too strong an impression on his mind to close with this warm declaration. He took his leave, however, that moment, and waited on the chiefs. He communicated to them the substance of their private conversation, and prevailed with them to make it a law for the future that no widow should be allowed to fall a victim to a deceased husband till after she had admitted some young man to converse with her in private for a whole hour together. The law was passed accordingly, and not one widow in all Arabia from that day to this ever observed the custom. 'Twas to Zadig alone that the Arabian dames were indebted for the abolition in 1 hour of a custom so very inhuman that had been practiced for such a number of ages. Zadig, therefore, with the strictest justice, was looked upon by all the fair sex in Arabia as their most bountiful benefactor. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Zadig, or the Book of Fate, by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org, Zadig, or the Book of Fate, Chapter 11, The Evening's Entertainment. Satak, who would never stir out without his bosom friend, in whom alone, as he thought, all wisdom centered, resolved to take him with him to Balzora Fair, whither the richest merchants round the whole habitable globe used annually to resort. Zadig was delighted to see such a concourse of substantial tradesmen from all countries assembled together in one place. It appeared to him as if the whole universe was but one large family, and all happily met together at Balzora. On the second day of the fair, he sat down to table with an Egyptian, an Indian that lived on the banks of the river Ganges, an inhabitant of Cathay, a Grecian, a Celt, and several other foreigners who, by their frequent voyages towards the Arabian Gulf, were so far conversant with the Arabic language as to be able to discourse freely and be mutually understood. The Egyptian began to fly into a passion. "What a scandalous place is this Balzora," said he, "where they refuse to lend me 1,000 ounces of gold upon the best security that can possibly be offered." "Pray," said Satak, "what may the commodity be that you would deposit as a pledge for the sum you mention?" "Why, the corpse of my deceased aunt," said he, "who was one of the finest women in all Egypt. She was my constant companion, but unhappily died upon the road. I've taken so much care that no mummy whatever can equal it, and was I in my own country, I could be furnished with what sum soever I pleased were I disposed to mortgage it. 'Tis a strange thing that nobody here will advance so small a sum upon so valuable a commodity." No sooner had he expressed his resentment, but he was going to cut up a fine boiled pullet in order to make a meal on't, when an Indian laid hold of his hand and with deep concern cried out, "For God's sake, what are you about?" "Why," said the Egyptian, "I design to make a wing of this fowl, one part of my supper." "Pray, good sir, consider what you are doing," said the Indian. "'Tis very possible that the soul of the deceased lady may have taken its residence in that fowl. And you wouldn't surely run the risk of eating up your aunt. To boil a fowl is doubtless a most shameful outrage done to nature. Pshaw, what a pother you make about the boiling of a fowl and flying in the face of nature," replied the Egyptian in a pet. "Though we Egyptians pay divine adoration to the ox, yet we can make a hearty meal of a piece of roast beef for all that. Is it possible, sir, that your countrymen should act so absurdly as to pay an ox the tribute of divine worship?" said the Indian. "Absurd as you think it," said the other. "The ox has been the principal object of adoration all over Egypt for these 135,000 years, and the most abandoned Egyptian has never been as yet so impious as to gainsay it." "Ay, sir, 135,000 years, say you. Surely you must be out a little in your calculation. 'Tis but about 40,000 years since India was first inhabited. Sure I am. We are more ancient people than you are, and our Brahma prohibited the eating of beef long before your nation ever erected an altar in honor of the ox or ever put one upon a spit. What a racket you make about your Brahma! Is he able to stand the least in competition with our Apis? Said the Egyptian. Let us hear, pray, what mighty feats have been done by your boasted Brahma. Why, replied the Brahmin, he first taught his votaries to write and read, and 'tis to him alone all the world is indebted for the invention of the noble game of chess. You are quite out, sir, in your notion, said a Chaldean who sat within hearing. All these invaluable blessings were derived from the fish Oannes, and 'tis that alone to which the tribute of divine adoration is justly due. All the world will tell you that 'twas the divine being whose tail was pure gold, whose head resembled that of a man, though indeed the features were much more beautiful, and that he condescended to visit the earth 3 hours every day for the instruction of mankind. He had a numerous issue, as is very well known, and all of them were powerful monarchs. I have a picture of it at home, to which, as in duty I ought, I say my prayers at night before I go to bed, and every morning that I rise. There is no harm, sir, as I can conceive, in partaking of a piece of roast beef, but doubtless 'tis a mortal sin, a crime of the blackest dye, to touch a piece of fish. Besides, you cannot justly boast of so lustrous an origin, and you are both of you mere moderns in comparison to us Chaldeans. You Egyptians lay claim to know more than 135,000 years, and you Indians but of 80,000, whereas we have almanacs that are dated 4,000 centuries backwards. Take my word for it, I speak nothing but truth. Renounce your errors, and I'll make each of you a present of a fine portrait of our Oannes. A native of Kambalu, entering into the debate, said, I have a very great veneration, not only for the Egyptians, Chaldeans, Greeks, and Celti, but for Brahma, Apis, and the Oannes. But in my humble opinion, the Li, or as 'tis by some called the Tien, is an object more deserving of divine adoration than any ox or fish, how much soever you may boast of their respective perfections. All I shall say in regard to my native country, 'tis of much greater extent than all Egypt, Chaldea, and the Indies put together. I shall lay no stress on the antiquity of my country, for I imagine 'tis of much greater importance to be the happiest people than the most ancient under the sun. However, since you were talking of the almanacs, I must beg the liberty to tell you that ours are looked upon to be the best all over Asia, and that we had several very correct ones before the art of arithmetic was ever heard of in Chaldea. You are all of you a parcel of illiterate, ignorant bigots, cried a Grecian. 'Tis plain you know nothing of the chaos, and that the world, as it now stands, is owing wholly to matter and form. The Greek ran on for a considerable time, but was at last interrupted by a Celt, who, having drank deep during the whole time of this debate, thought himself 10 times wiser than any of his antagonists, and rapping out a great oath, insisted that all their gods were nothing if set in competition with the Tuatha or the mistletoe on the oak. As for my party, said he, I carry some of it always in my pocket. As to my ancestors, they were Scythians, and the only men worth talking of in the whole world. 'Tis true, indeed, they would now and then make a meal of their countrymen, but that ought not to be urged as any objection to his country. And in short, if any one of you, or all of you, shall dare to say anything disrespectful of Tuatha, I'll defend its cause to the last drop of my blood. The quarrel grew warmer and warmer, and Satak expected that the table would be overset, and that bloodshed would ensue. Zadig, who hadn't once opened his lips during the whole controversy, at last rose up and addressed himself to the Celt in the first place as being the most noisy and outrageous. Sir, said he, your notions in this affair are very just. Good, sir, oblige me with a bit of your mistletoe. Then turning about, he expatiated on the eloquence of the Grecian, and in a word softened in the most artful manner all the contending parties. He said but little indeed to the Carthaean, because he was more cool and sedate than any of the others. To conclude, he addressed them all in general terms to this or the like effect. My dear friends, you have been contesting all this while about an important topic in which 'tis evident you are all unanimously agreed. Agreed, quotha, they all cried in an angry tone. How so, pray? Why, said he to the hot, testy Celt, is it not true that you do not in effect adore this mistletoe, but that being who created that mistletoe and the oak to which it is so closely united? Doubtless, sir, replied the Celt. And you, sir, said he to the Egyptian, you revere through your venerable Apis the great author of every ox's being. We do so, said the Egyptian. the mighty Oannes, though the sovereign of the sea, continued he, must give precedence to the power who made both the sea and every fish that dwells therein. We allow it, said the Chaldean. The Indians, Adsi, and the Cathayan acknowledge one supreme being or first cause as well as you. As to what that profound worthy gentleman, the Grecian, has advanced, is, I must own, a little above my weak comprehension, but I'm fully persuaded that he will allow there is a supreme being on whom his favorite matter and form are entirely dependent. The Grecian, who was looked upon as a sage amongst them, said with abundance of gravity that Zadig had made a very just construction of his meaning. Now, gentlemen, I appeal to you all, said Zadig, whether you are not unanimous to a man in the debate upon the carpet, and whether there are any just grounds for the least divisions or animosities amongst you. The whole company cool at once caressed him, and Setoc, after he had sold off all his goods and merchandise at a round price, took his friend Zadig home with him to the land of Horeb. Zadig, upon his first arrival, was informed that a prosecution had been carried on against him during his absence, and that the sentence pronounced against him was that he should be burnt alive before a slow fire. End of chapter 11.
Chapter 12 of Zadig by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig. Chapter 12. The Rendezvous. Whilst Zadig attended his friend Setoc to Balzora, the priests of the stars were determined to punish him, as all the costly jewels and other valuable decorations in which every young widow that sacrificed herself on her husband's funeral pile were their customary fee. 'Tis no great wonder, indeed, that they were inclined to burn poor Zadig for playing them such a scurvy trick. Zadig, therefore, was accused of holding heretical and damnable tenets in regard to the celestial host. They deposed and swore point-blank that he had been heard to aver that the stars never sat in the sea. This horrid blasphemous declaration thunderstruck all the judges, and they were ready to rend their mantles at the sound of such an impious assertion, and they would have made Zadig, had he been a man of substance, paid very severely for his heretical notions. But in the height of their pity and compassion for even such an infidel, they would lay no fine upon him, but content themselves with seeing him roasted alive before a slow fire. Setoc, though without hopes of success, used all the interest he had to save his bosom friend from so shocking a death, but they turned a deaf ear to all his remonstrances, and obliged him to hold his tongue. The young widow Almona, who by this time was not only reconciled to living a little longer, but had some taste for the pleasures of life, and knew that she was entirely indebted to Zadig for it, resolved, if possible, to free her benefactor from being burned, as he had before convinced her of the folly of it in her case. She pondered upon this weighty affair very seriously, but said nothing to any one whomsoever. Zadig was to be executed the next day, and she had only a few hours left to carry her project into execution. Now the reader shall hear with how much benevolence and discretion this amiable widow behaved on this emergent occasion. In the first place, she made use of the most costly perfumes and dressed herself to the utmost advantage to render her charms as conspicuous as possible, and thus, gaily attired, demanded a private audience of the high priest of the stars. Upon her first admittance into his august and venerable presence, she addressed herself in the following terms: O thou firstborn and well-beloved son of the Great Bear, brother of the bull, and first cousin to the dog, These, you must know, were the pontiff's high titles. I come to confess myself before you. My conscience is my accuser, and I am terribly afraid I have been guilty of a mortal sin by declining the stated custom of burning myself on my husband's funeral pile. What could tempt me, in short, to a prolongation of my life, I can't imagine. I, who am grown a perfect skeleton, all wrinkled and deformed. She paused, and pulling off, with a negligent but artful air, her long silk gloves, she displayed a soft, plump, naked arm, and white as snow. "You see, sir," said she, "that all my charms are blasted." "Blasted, madame," said the Lucius Pontiff. "No, your charms are still resistless." His eyes and his mouth, with which he kissed her hand, confirmed their power. "Such an arm, madame, by the great Erasmus, I never saw before." "Alas," said the widow, with a modest blush, "my arm, sir, 'tis probable, may have the advantage of any hidden part. But see, good father, what a neck is here, as yellow as saffron, an object not worth regarding." Then she displayed such a snowy, panting bosom, that nature could not mend it. A rosebud on an ivory apple would, if set in competition with her spotless whiteness, make no better appearance than common madder upon a shrub. And the whitest wool, just out of the laver, were she but by, would seem but of a light brown hue. Her neck, her large black sparkling eyes, that languishingly rolled and seemed as 'twere on fire, her lovely cheeks glowing with white and red, her nose that was not unlike the tower of Mount Lebanon, her lips which were like two borders of coral, enclosing two rows of the best pearls in the Arabian Sea. Such a combination, I say, of charms made the old pontiff judge she was scarce 20 years of age, and in a kind of flutter to make her a declaration of his tender regard for her. Almona, perceiving him enamoured, begged his interest in favour of Zadig. "Alas, my dear charmer, my interest alone, when you request the favour, would be but a poor compliment. I'll take care his acquittance shall be signed by 3 more of my brother priests." "Do you sign first, however," said Almona. "With all my soul," said the amorous pontiff, "provided you will be kind, my dearest." "You do me too much honour," said Almona. "But should you give yourself the trouble to pay me a visit after sunset, and as soon as the star sheet twinkles on the horizon, you shall find me, most venerable father, reposed upon a rosy-coloured silver sofa, where you shall use your pleasure with your humble servant." With that, she made him a low courtesy, took up Zadig's general release as soon as duly signed, and left the old dotard all over love, though somewhat diffident of his own abilities. The residue of the day he spent in his bagnio. He drank large, enlivening draughts of a water distilled from the cinnamon of Ceylon, and the costly spices of Tidore and Ternate, and waited with the utmost impatience for the uprising of the brilliant sheet. In the meantime, Almona went to the second pontiff. He assured her that the sun, moon, and all the starry host of heaven were but languid fires to her bright eyes. He put the question to her, in short, at once, and agreed to sign upon her compliance. She suffered herself to be over-persuaded, and made an assignation to meet him at a certain place, as soon as the star Aljanib should make its appearance. From him she repaired to the third and fourth pontiff, taking care wherever she went to see Zadig's acquittance duly signed, and made fresh appointments in the rising of star after star. When she had carried her point thus far, she sent a proper message to the judges of the court who had condemned Zadig, requesting that they would come to her house, that she might advise with them upon an affair of the last importance. They waited on her accordingly. She produced Zadig's discharge, duly signed by four several hands, and told them the definitive treaty between all the contracting parties. Each of the pontifical gallants observed their summons to a moment. Each was startled at the sight of his rival, but perfectly thunderstruck to see the judges before whom the widow had laid open her case. Zadig procured an absolute pardon, and Setoc was so charmed with the artful address of Almona that he married her the next day. Zadig went afterwards to throw himself at the feet of his fair benefactress. Setoc and he took their leave of each other with tears in their eyes, and vowing that an eternal mutual friendship should be preserved between them, and in short, should fortune at any time afterwards prove more propitious than could well be expected to either party, the other should partake of an equal share of his success. Zadig steered his course towards Syria, forever pondering on the hard fate of the justly admired Astarte, and reflecting on his own stars that so obstinately darted down their malignant rays and continued daily to torment him. "What," said he, "to pay 400 ounces of gold for only seeing a bitch pass by me, to be condemned to be beheaded for 4 witless verses in praise of the king, to be strangled to death because a queen was pleased to look upon me, to be made a prisoner and sold as a slave for saving a young lady from being sorely abused by a brute rather than a man, and to be upon the brink of being roasted alive for no other offence than saving for the future all the widows in Arabia from becoming idol burnt offerings and mingling their ashes with those of their deceased worthless husbands." End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Zadig, The Book of Fate by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig, The Book of Fate, Chapter 13, The Freebooter. Zadig, arriving at the frontiers which separate Arabia Petraea from Syria, and passing by a very strong castle, several armed Arabians rushed out upon him, and surrounding him, cried out, "Whatever you have belonging to you is our property, but as for your person, that is entirely at our sovereign's disposal." Zadig, instead of making any reply, drew his sword, and as his attendant was a very courageous fellow, he drew likewise. Those who laid hold on them first fell a sacrifice to their fury, their numbers redoubled, yet still, both dauntless, determined to conquer or to die. When two men defend themselves against a whole gang, the contest, doubtless, cannot last long. The master of the castle, one Erbogad by name, having been an eyewitness from his window of the intrepidity and surprising exploits of Zadig, took a fancy to him. He ran down, therefore, in haste, and giving orders himself to his vassals to desist, delivered the two travellers out of their hands. "Whatever goods or chattels," said he, "come upon my territories, are my effects. and whatever I find likewise that is valuable upon the premises of others is my free booty. But as you appear, sir, to me to be a gentleman of uncommon courage, you shall prove an exception to my general rule. Upon this, he invited Zadig into his magnificent mansion, giving his inferior officers strict orders to use him with all due respect. And at night, Arbogad was desirous of supping with Zadig. The lord of the mansion was one of those Arabians that are called freebooters, but a man who now and then did good actions amongst a thousand bad ones. He plundered without mercy, but was liberal in his benefactions. When in action intrepid, but in traffic easy enough, a perfect epicure in his eating and drinking, an absolute debauchee, but very frank and open. Zadig pleased him extremely, his conversation being very lively, prolonged their repast. At last, Arbogad said to him, "I would advise you, sir, to enlist yourself in my troop. You cannot possibly do a better thing. My profession is none of the worst, and in time you may become perhaps as great a man as myself. May I presume, sir, to ask you one question? How long may you have followed this honorable calling?" "From my youth upwards," replied his host, "I was only a valet, at first to an Arabian, who indeed was courteous enough. But servitude was a state of life I could not brook. It made me stark mad to see in a wide world, which ought to be divided fairly between mankind, that fate had reserved for me so scanty a portion. I communicated my grievance to an old sage Arabian. 'Son,' said he, 'never despair. Once upon a time there was a grain of sand that bemoaned itself as being nothing more than a worthless atom of the deserts. At the expiration, however, of a few years, it became that inestimable diamond which at this very hour is the richest and most admired ornament of the Indian crown.' The old man's discourse fired me with some ambition. I was conscious to myself that I was at that time the atom he mentioned, but was determined, if possible, to become the diamond. At my first setting out, I stole 2 horses. Then I got into a gang, where we played at small game and stopped the small caravans. Thus I gradually lessened the wide disproportion which there was at first between me and the rest of mankind. I enjoyed not only my full share of the good things of this life, but enjoyed them with usury. I was looked upon as a man of consequence, and I procured this castle by my military achievements. The satrap of Syria had thoughts of dispossessing me, but I was then too rich to be any ways afraid of him. I gave the satrap a certain sum of money upon condition that I kept quiet possession of my castle, and moreover I aggrandized my domains, for he constituted me at the same time treasurer of the imports that Arabia Petria paid to the King of Kings. I executed my trust in every respect as I ought in the capacity of a collector, but I never did nor never intended to balance my accounts. The Grand Desterham of Babylon sent hither in the name of the King Moabdar a petty satrap with a commission to strangle me. He and his attendants arrived here with his royal warrant. I was apprised of the whole affair, and accordingly ordered his whole retinue, consisting of 4 inferior officers, to be strangled before his face, after the same manner as was intended for my execution. After this, I asked him what he thought the commission with which he was entrusted might reasonably be valued at. He answered that he presumed his premium, had he succeeded, might have amounted to about 300 pieces of gold. I made him sensible that it would be for his interest to be a commissioned officer under me. I made him accordingly deputy freebooter. He is at this very day not only the best officer, but the richest I have in all my court. If my word may be credited, I'll raise your fortune as I have done his. Never was trade brisker in our way, for Moabdar is knocked on the head, and all Babylon is the utmost confusion. Moabdar killed, said you, cried Zadig. And pray, sir, what is become of his royal consort, Astarte? I know nothing at all of that affair, replied Arbogad. All that I have to say is that Moabdar became a perfect madman and had his brains beat out, that all the people in Babylon are cutting one another's throats, and that the whole empire is laid waste, that there is still an opportunity for making several bold pushes. And let me tell you, sir, I have done my part and made the most on it. But the queen, sir, said Zadig, pray favour me so far as to inform me if you know my thing of the queen. I have heard great talk, said he, of a certain prince of Hircania. 'Tis very possible she may have listed herself amongst his concubines. If she had the good fortune to escape the resentment of those popular tumults. But my head, sir, is better turned for the highway than for news. I have taken several ladies prisoners in the course of my excursions. I keep none of them for my part, and as to such as are handsomer than ordinary, I make the best market I can of them, without inquiring who they are. Their quality or titles will fetch no price at all. A queen, if she be homely, is worth noting. 'Tis probably, sir, I have disposed of the lady myself, and 'tis possible, likewise, she may be dead. 'Tis no concern of mine, and to my thinking, it should be an affair of no manner of importance to you. After this declaration, he drank so hard and confounded his ideas in such a manner that Zadig was not one whit the wiser, upon which he was struck dumb, confounded, and stood as motionless as a statue. Arbogad, in the meanwhile, swilled down whole bumpers, told 100 merry tales, and swore 1,000 times over that he was the happiest creature upon God's earth, persuading Zadig to be as merry and thoughtless as himself. At last, being gradually overcome by the fumes of his liquor, he fell fast asleep. Zadig spent the remainder of the night in deep contemplation and in all the uneasiness of mind imaginable. What, said he, the king first became crazy and then was murdered? I think I have just grounds for complaint. The whole empire is in confusion and torn to pieces, and this freebooter is as happy as a king. O fortune, O fate, a highwayman as happy as a monarch, and the most amiable creature that nature ever framed has suffered, perhaps, an ignominious death, or perhaps is in a state of life 1,000 times worse than death itself. O Astarte, Astarte, what art thou become? As soon as it was break of day, he went out, and asked every one he saw if they knew anything of her. But the whole gang were too intent upon other matters to return him any answer. By virtue of their night's excursions, they had brought in some fresh booty, and were busy in dividing the spoil. All the favour he could procure in the hurry and tumult was to go away, without the least examination. He took the advantage of their remissness and moved off the premises, but more overwhelmed with grief and deep reflection than ever. Zadig, in his march, was very restless and uneasy. His thoughts were forever rolling on the unfortunate Astarte, the king of Babylon, his bosom friend Cador, the happy freebooter Arbogad, the fair Coquette that was taken prisoner on the confines of Egypt by the Babylonish courier. In a word, on the various scenes of misfortunes and disappointments which he had successively met with. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Zadig, The Book of Fate by Voltaire. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Zadig. Chapter 14. The Fisherman. When Zadig had travelled some few leagues from Arbogad's castle, he found himself arrived at the banks of a little river, incessantly deploring as he went along his unhappy fate, and looking upon himself as the very prince of ill luck. He perceived at a little distance a fisherman reclined on a verdant bank by the river side, trembling, scarce able to hold his net in his hand, which he seemed but little to regard, and with uplift eyes imploring heaven's assistance. "I am doubtless," said the poor fisherman, "the most unhappy wretch that ever lived. No merchant in all Babylon, it is very well known, was ever so noted for selling cream cheeses as myself, and yet I am ruined to all intents and purposes. No man of my profession ever had a handsomer, more complete housewife than my dame was. But I have been treacherously deprived of her. I had still left a poor, pitiful cottage, but that I saw plundered and destroyed. I am cubbed up here in a cell. I have nothing to depend upon but my fishery, and not one single fish have I caught. Thou unfortunate net, I'll never throw thee into the water more. Much sooner will I throw myself in." No sooner were the words out of his mouth, but he started up and ran to the riverside like one that was resolutely bent to plunge in and get rid of a miserable life at once. "Is it possible," said Zadig, "is there then the man in being more wretched than myself? His benevolence and goodwill to save the poor man's life was as quick as the reflection he had just made. He ran to his assistance, he laid hold of him, and asked him, with an air of pity and concern, the cause of his rash intention. 'Tis an old saying that a person is less unhappy when he sees himself not singular in misfortune. But if we will credit Zoroaster, this is not from a principle of malignity, but the effect of a fatal necessity. He was attracted, as it were, to any person in distress as being one in the same unhappy circumstances. The transport of a happy man would be a kind of insult. But two persons in bad circumstances are like two weak shrubs, which, by propping up each other, are fenced against a storm." "Why are you thus cast down?" said Zadig to the fisherman. "Never sink, man, under the weight of your burden." "I can't help it," said the poor fisherman. "I have not the least prospect of redress. I was once, sir, the tip-top man of the whole village of Derbach, near Babylon, where I lived, and with the help of my wife made the best cream cheeses that were ever eaten in the Persian Empire. Her Majesty the Queen Astarte and the famous Prime Minister Zadig were very fond of them. I served the court with about 600 of them. I went the other day in hopes of being paid, but before I had got into the suburbs of Babylon. I was never set eye on the man in all my life. There I found the court marshals of the Grand Desterham, plundering, by virtue of his majesty's mandate, all his effects in the most loyal manner. From thence I made the best of my way to the queen's kitchen, where, applying myself to the steward of her household and his inferior officers, one of them told me she was dead, another that she was confined in prison, a third, indeed, said that she had made her escape by flight. All in general, however, assured me for my comfort that my cheeses would never be paid for. From thence I went, with my wife in my hand, to Lord Orkans, who was another of my court customers, of whom we begged for shelter and protection. The favour, I confess, was readily granted to my wife, but as for my own part, I was absolutely rejected. She was fairer, sir, than the fairest cheese I ever sold, from whence I date all my misfortunes, and the red that adorned her blushing cheeks was 10 times more lively than any Tyrian scarlet. And between you and I, sir, that was the main cause of my wife's reception and my disgrace. Whereupon I wrote a doleful letter to my wife, in all the agonies of one in the deepest despair. "'Tis very well," said she to the messenger. "I have some little knowledge of the man. I have heard say no one sells better cream cheeses than he does. Desire him, next time he comes, to bring a small parcel with him, and let him know. I'll take care he shall be punctually paid." In the height of my misfortunes, I determined to seek redress in a court of equity. I had but 6 ounces of gold left, 2 whereof went for a fee to my counsellor, 2 to my lawyer, who took my cause in hand, and the other 2 to the judge's clerk. Notwithstanding what I had done, my cause was not so much as commenced, and I had already disbursed more money than all my cheeses and my wife with them were worth. I returned, therefore, to my native habitation with a full resolution to sell it for the ransom of my wife. My little cot, with the appurtenances, were worth about 60 ounces of gold. But as the purchasers found I was necessitous and drove to my last shifts, the first whom I applied to offered me 30 ounces, the second 20, and the third but 10, just as I had come to terms of accommodation with one of them. The Prince of Arsania came to Babylon and swept all before him. My little cottage, with all its furniture, was first plundered of all that was valuable, and at last reduced to ashes. Having thus lost my money, my wife, and my house, I withdrew to this desert, where you see me. I have since endeavoured to get my bread by fishing, but the fish, as well as all mankind, desert me. I scarce catch one in a day. I am half-starved, and had it not been for your unexpected benevolence and generosity, I had been at the bottom of the river before this. This long detail of particulars, however, was not delivered without several interruptions, for, said Zadig, with abundance of warmth and confusion, "Have you never heard, sir, of what has become of the Queen Astarte?" "No, sir, not I," said the disconsolate fisherman. "But this I know, to my sorrow, that neither the Queen nor Zadig ever paid me the least consideration in the world for my cream cheeses, that my dear spouse is taken from me, and that I am drove to the very brink of despair. I am verily persuaded," said Zadig, "that you will not lose all your money. I have heard much talk of that same Zadig. They say he is very honest, and that, if ever he returns to Babylon, as 'tis to be hoped he will discharge his debts with interest, like a man of honour. But as for your wife, who appears to me to be no better than a wagtail, never take the trouble if you will take advice to hunt after her any more. Be ruled, and make the best of your way to Babylon. I shall be there before you, as I shall ride, and you will be on foot. Make your applications to the illustrious Kedar. Tell him you met his friend upon the road, and stay there till I come. Observe my orders, and 'tis very probable it may turn out to your advantage. O puissant Oros maids, continued he, you have made me, 'tis true, an instrument of comfort to this poor man. But what friend will you raise for me to alleviate my sorrows? Having uttered this short expostulation, he gave the distressed fisherman one full moiety of all the money he brought with him out of Arabia. The fisherman, thunderstruck and transported with joy at so unexpected a benefaction, kissed the feet of Kedar's friend and cried out, "Sure, you are a messenger of heaven, sent down to be my savior." In the meantime, Zadig every now and then asked him questions and wept as he asked them. "What, sir," said the fisherman, "can you, who are so bountiful a benefactor, be in distress yourself?" "Alas," said he, "friend, I am 100 times more unhappy than thou art." "But pray, sir," said the good man, "how can it possibly be that he who is so lavish of his favors should be overwhelmed with greater misfortunes than the man he so generously relieves?" "Your greatest uneasiness," said he, "arose from the narrowness of your circumstances, but mine proceeds from an internal and much deeper cause." "Pray, sir," said the fisherman, "has Orcan robbed you of your wife?" This interrogatory put Zadig in a moment upon a retrospection of all his past adventures. He recollected the whole series of his misfortunes, commencing from that of the eunuch and the huntsman to his arrival at the freebooter's castle. "Alas," said he to the fisherman, "Orcan, 'tis true, deserves severely to be punished, but for the generality, we find such worthless barbarians are the favorites of fortune. Be that, however, as it will, go as I bid you, to my friend Kedar, and wait there till I come." They took their leave, the fisherman blessing his propitious stars, and Zadig cursing every step he went, the hour he was born. End of chapter 14.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.